The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and we're going to start at a place that most of us visited as a child, and probably been there since with our children or grandchildren. It's the American Museum of Natural History, who's commemorating its 150th anniversary this year. And their president, Ellen Futter, tells us they kicked off the anniversary just as you would have expected.
Well, we did have a sense that maybe the way to kick off our sesquicentennial was obviously with T-Rex. But the reason that it was so appropriate, apart from T-Rex just being inherently cool, is also that there's so much new science about T-Rex. You know, it just never gets old. And our scientists are out there every year and finding new things. And so today we know that they may have had feathers. Mm-hmm. Today we're trying to figure out what color were they. Today we can literally recreate, and we do in the exhibit, what the power of their crunch and bite was. I mean, this is very cool stuff.
And then I'll speak with David Flink and Marcus Sutra of Eye to Eye, an organization that helps children with learning disabilities. And David has this to say about dyslexia.
One of the things I would actually add is an interesting part about what is dyslexia. That circuitous route, that different thinking brain, also has unleashed a lot of creative thinking, a lot of problem-solving skills that other people don't have. So dyslexia is an interesting paradox of a struggle with one thing, and also there's a lot of research now to say a gift with another.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, June 2nd. Locking away people who have committed assault, robbery, and similar felonies may keep them off the streets for a period of time, but it does not affect whether they will commit violent crimes after their release, according to new research from UC Berkeley. Around 420 million children are currently living in conflict-affected countries, more than at any time in the last 20 years. Many are deliberately targeted by armed combatants for heinous crimes, including killing, rape, and kidnapping. Compared to patients who see their primary care doctor earlier in the day, cancer screening rates decline significantly as the day goes on, according to a new study. Researchers believe these rates of decline may be in part due to decision fatigue, which results from the cumulative burden of screening discussions earlier in the day and doctors falling behind in their busy schedules. People in the cities with plastic bag bans at stores used fewer plastic bags. But people who used to reuse their shopping bags for other purposes, like picking up dog poop or lining trash bins, still needed bags. So the sales of garbage bags have skyrocketed with a 120% increase in sales after bans went into effect. And finally, scared students are rejecting colleges in states with strict abortion laws. Missouri, Kentucky, Mississippi, Ohio, Georgia, and Louisiana have passed so-called heartbeat bills this year. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Ellen Futter of the American Museum of Natural History right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
There are few institutions that generate such universal love and respect as does the American Museum of Natural History. And we can add appreciation to that as well, as this year they are celebrating their 150th anniversary. And here to share with us their story and what they have planned for their sesquicentennial anniversary is Ellen Futter, the president of the American Museum of Natural History. Good evening, Ellen, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening, and thank you for having me.
So it was 1869. The incorporation papers were signed on April 6th when the American Museum of Natural History came into being. What is the founding story of that institution, Ellen?
Well, it's really an interesting story because so many of New York's civic leaders were admiring of institutions of natural history around the world, particularly, I think, the British Natural History Museum. And they thought, as the leaders of this great city in New York, that New York ought to have one of its own. And so they founded the American, in contrast to the British, Museum of Natural History right here in New York City.
And it was originally in Central Park, correct?
It was originally in the Armory in Central Park. And then, of course, we developed our own site and facility.
The breadth and scope of the museum is simply remarkable. You have some 34 million objects in your collection. Provide us with an overview of the museum.
Well, what's really unique about the American Museum of Natural History is precisely what you said, its scope. There are many natural history museums that might cover the biological sciences, but they don't necessarily cover astrophysics, earth and planetary sciences, not to mention anthropology. And our scope is all of that, which means pretty much, not absolutely, but pretty much everything can fall within our ambit. And that's a very luxurious place to be, particularly in terms of presenting topics to the public. But separate from just the intellectual scope, the content scope, is what happens inside the museum. The fact that we not only have those collections of 34 million specimens and objects, which is enormous, but also that we have 200 research scientists on staff, that we have probably the largest natural history library all in one place and under our roof in the Western Hemisphere, that in addition to the collections and the library and the scientists, and the laboratories, many of them among the most high-tech that you can find anywhere. We also have our own graduate school. We give our own PhD in comparative biology, and we also give an MAT in the Master of Teaching Science, which has never been more important than it is today. So that's a great deal of scope, plus exhibitions, which is what the public knows us best for.
That's right.
45 permanent galleries. Plus the Rose Center for Earth and Space with its planetarium and space show, as well as having a huge educational enterprise. We're training some 4,000 to 5,000 teachers a year in teaching science education. We have extensive public programs. We're the most visited museum in New York City for children visiting in school groups with teachers and parents and also with camp groups. So it's an enormous sweep of activity and an enormous opportunity to bring science and nature and human cultures to the public.
How many visitors do you have every year, and where do they tend to gravitate to once they step into the museum?
Well, I love all of my children equally. but having said that, we have about 5 million visitors
wow.
a year, which is a lot of visitors. And there are certain things they always love, and then there's surprises. So among the always and most popular, obviously dinosaurs, dinosaurs, and dinosaurs. but the big blue whale in the Milstein Hall of Ocean Life.
It takes three days to clean that, doesn't it?
Well, it can. Yes, it does, actually. It is a great favorite. The planetarium is enormous. Popular. And of course, some things post night at the museum, the movie, everybody wants to go to Pacific Peoples and see the wonderful statue that they remember so well. The dioramas are forever popular.
Mm-hmm.
The Bernard Hall of North American Mammals, the Akeley Gallery of African Mammals. These are places of childhood memories, including my own.
Yeah.
Really very, very special. I always say about the dioramas that they were actually the first virtual reality.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
And you can actually spend the night in the museum, can't you?
You can actually spend a night at the museum on purpose now.
Yeah.
You know, it's a remarkable thing. That night at the museum where you can sleep under the whale, it's magical. And before you get to sleep under the whale, you get a flashlight tour of the dinosaur galleries, a late night viewing of the space show. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, it sounds that way. Well, museums help to contextualize data and information for us. So let me ask you to contextualize this. And how do you see the role of the Natural History Museum in the broader society?
Well, it's a very important question because as such a hybrid institution that does science, education, exhibition, public programs, we have a lot of – everybody's our audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the one hand, from a scientific perspective, very much we have to preserve – and we want to – and steward the collections. These are the evidence. This is one of the most important records of life on this good earth. And it's the evidence on which much science is done. And evidence, in fact, facts really matter. We take them seriously. In addition, the scientists conduct some 100 plus expeditions, field expeditions, all over the world every single year. And so the active science and the research that's taking place right in the laboratories, very often highly interdisciplinary, high tech, and addressing major issues of our time, is one critical aspect of what we do. Second, we want to bring and translate that scientific work and other scientific work to the public. Most of the issues of our time are actually scientifically based today, and most of the issues that the public is so concerned with and should be so concerned with: human health, the environment, the possibility of life beyond Earth, and I could go on with a long list.
You're absolutely
right. These are energy policy. These are things people go to the voting booth on. Think about the health issues today, vaccinations. I mean, these things really, really matter. So what we try to do is bring current topics to the public, not as a lesson and not as a textbook, but through a unique style of interpretation and presentation of an exhibition. And then we take an exhibition and a theme that we've developed, and we translate it for teachers, for schools, for presentation on the internet, and for learning anywhere, anytime, by individuals, by children, adults, and families, alone, together, however is best for them, in whatever language, at whatever age.
Yeah, and you're taking these current issues and you're presenting them in a very current way, because museums are truly in the digital age. Apps, learning portals, virtual and augmented reality, these things are all being deployed to enhance the visitor's experience. How do you approach these emerging technologies, and how do you layer it on to what the museum already was?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, when the digital world was first emerging in museums, I think there was some, not so much in ours, honestly, because as a scientific institution, we tend to embrace technology very fast.
Yes.
We live it and we breathe it. But nonetheless, as a general matter, I think for institutions, there was a sense that, well, you know, That's one side of life, and then there's the actual what happens on site.
Mm-hmm.
And then more and more they began to come together. And from my perspective, and I know our museum's perspective, they really are mutually reinforcing. And the way that we think about it is that visitors now come to us or are visitors both online and on site. And what we want is a flow for them to be able to go back and forth from the virtual to the on-site, and to have it be a recognizable and accreting, advancing experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not in contention with one another, but rather mutually reinforcing. And frankly, there's some things you can do better online and some things you can do better on-site.
That's right. Well, let's talk about on-site and getting back to the dioramas. Some of the exhibits that were created decades ago don't fully or accurately reflect the history that is depicted in those scenes. And let me just cite one example. And that would be the diorama with Peter Stuyvesant, the colonial governor of New Netherland. And he was meeting with the Lenape and indigenous tribe inhabiting New Amsterdam. An example of that would be a diorama with Peter Stuyvesant, colonial governor of New Netherland, meeting with the Lenape, an indigenous tribe inhabiting New Amsterdam. What was wrong with the way that scene was depicted, and what did the museum do to help address it?
It's such an interesting project, and it's a manifestation of an interesting issue for institutions that are as old as we are, 150 years,
yeah,
and that are as large as we are, and that's that sometimes things get out of date. This was an example of a diorama that was not only out of date, but inappropriately so, and we were trying to figure out how to address it most effectively. And after a great deal of introspection and dialogue about that, we decided that the best way to do it was explicitly and overtly, so that the public could engage in how things had changed with us. In other words, not take the diorama out, not simply remove the inappropriate signage, but rather to layer literally on top of the glass new signage that shared with people the fact that some of the presentations were stereotypical. Many of them were inappropriate culturally and inaccurate. And so what we did was we put a big label right across the glass of the diorama and said, what's wrong with this picture? And then we went through issue by issue, the dress of the Native Americans,
mm-hmm,
the stance of the original New Yorkers, and how it was all off balance and inaccurate and in the wrong cultural representation, and we corrected it.
Yeah, that is so smart and so thoughtful. Because if we're going to face our history, sometimes it has to be presented. And there are so many others who would have wanted to throw a blanket over it and pretend it never happened. And that doesn't do anybody any good.
But you know what's very interesting? So many more people are stopping to look at this diorama.
That's great.
They used to walk past it, which may have been a good thing when it was out of date that they weren't taking it in. But now that it's been treated, they can see that there's something different. And they're stopping and they're reading and they're really enjoying it. It's been extremely well received. And we're proud of it, but we are still learning and we're still working on these issues of how to best take each explicit case of this and have the right intervention and the right treatment.
A very constructive approach. You have been deeply concerned about the state of science learning in the schools and the urgent need to improve it. And your institution, although you're a museum, you're doing more and more science-based learning, and you're doing it in a very creative and innovative way. Tell us about some of those efforts.
Well, it goes all the way back to those founders you asked about, because one of the great insights they had was, in addition to making us a traditional museum and a place of scientific research, they also specifically wrote in to our charter that we'd be a place for what was then fairly charmingly called popular instruction, which is code for education.
Yes.
And so we've always had a really important blend mission of science and education that's only grown, I think, more and more in the last period of years. And we feel that this is absolutely critical for the very reason that we were discussing before. As the issues of our time are more explicitly science-based, it is increasingly urgent that the general public have a capacity to engage those issues. In addition, I think it's vital for young people who are going to be coming forward at a time when most of the jobs are going to have levels of scientific dimensionality to them. It doesn't mean they're all going to be scientists. Then that we prepare them for the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, for our country's own competitiveness and security going forward, we have to be at the cutting edge. So we've taken a very strong position that we want to be the place that is training the next generation of scientists, the next generation of science teachers, and the next generation and the current generations of a scientifically literate populace that is prepared to exercise the franchise thoughtfully.
Yeah, and you certainly have an expertise in knowing how to present this science in an accessible and engaging way, perhaps even more than a lot of schools do.
Well, I think we're also relieved of the burden of having to present a textbook.
Yeah.
We have
State standards and things of that sort.
Well, but we keep our eye not only on the standards, but also on what the teachers are required to teach, because if we're going to be in the business, and we are, of training teachers, whether it's through our master's program or through programs that certify teachers for teaching science, it's critical that we meet them where they need to do their work and not ask them to go on a side adventure. And we're highly cognizant of that. For example, we have a program called Urban Advantage that we do with all of the other scientifically rich nonprofit institutions around New York, the Botanical Gardens, the zoos, the Hall of Science, et cetera, across all five boroughs. And it's in its 11th year. And we've been training thousands and thousands of teachers and students. And it meets them at the eighth grade exit project. They can't get promoted to the next grade without this. And it's a test in science. And so it's a real thing for them and for the teachers. They do their projects in our institutions. We work with their teachers as well. And we send all these children who go through this program home with free passes for their families. And they come back in with their siblings so proud to show them their institution. But I think this point of really having it tied to what the standards are, help teachers and schools fulfill those requirements, and in a sense, having the classroom extend beyond the walls of the schoolhouse into the great resources of a city like New York. And that's where the name is derived from, Urban Advantage, because for all the challenges of urban education, we have one great advantage, which is all these institutions that are here to participate. And it's really changed our role, actually, because it's not just that we're assisting. We're actually accountable with everybody for making these programs work.
Very cool. You also, Ellen, have been a big champion for girls in STEM. Are we gaining traction? Are we making headway in those efforts?
Well, I've been involved in STEM education for girls and women since my days at Barnard College.
Right.
And though I should say very quickly, as you know, I am not a scientist, though I have long loved nature and science.
Where did that come from? Because you were an English major.
Right.
You're a lawyer.
I am.
And you were the president of Barnard for 13 years. Where did that love from science emanate from?
It came from my childhood.
Yeah.
And I always loved nature. I collected. I was a little collector, like so many children are. I'm one of those little collectors. I collected shells. I collected rocks. I loved butterflies from a very young age. Still do all those things. Still collect those shells. And so it's always something I've cared about and understood. And I think that having a relationship with nature is so important at every stage of our life. It's grounding, literally. It's deeply moving, and it makes us care about where we are, the environment, and the world around us.
Well, let us get back to the sesquicentennial, because you have an ambitious slate of projects and exhibits and events which even extend beyond this year. And let us start with the place we have to start, which is dinosaurs. Tell us about T-Rex, the ultimate predator.
Well, we did have a sense that maybe the way to kick off our sesquicentennial was obviously with T-Rex. But the reason that it was so appropriate, apart from T-Rex just being inherently cool,
yes,
is also that there's so much new science about T-Rex. You know, it just never gets old. And our scientists are out there every year and finding new things. And so today we know that they may have had feathers.
Mm-hmm.
Today we're trying to figure out what color were they. Today we can literally recreate, and we do in the exhibit, what the power of their crunch and bite was. I mean, this is very cool stuff. We do use new technology, virtual reality, and all the rest in this show to demonstrate each of these things. So it's a very cool show. It looks and feels different, but it's still about everybody's favorite dinosaur.
And it should be noted that the man who discovered T-Rex was an employee of the museum.
Barnum Brown.
Yeah. Very cool.
Part of our history. Well, that's why we're celebrating. We do have, as you were alluding to, a great and glorious history, a wonderful culture. But I think what's so thrilling is to see how the idea that you were alluding to earlier for this institution began,
mm-hmm.
and how it's blossomed. Because for all of the vision and ambition that our founders had, I don't think that even they would have understood not just the role that we play in the city, which has also changed,
yeah.
not just a place to go, but a driving force in New York City itself, across five boroughs, and in education and for tourism, but also that we're playing a national role and a global role in science, in discovery, in education, and we're at the core of so many of the most important issues.
Mm-hmm. Another anniversary this year is going to be the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. What's going on up at the Hayden Planetarium?
Well, as you were saying, we have a lot of excitement around our 150th anniversary. We're an institution that knows how to party. And so, among other things, we're going to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the moonwalk, but we're going to also celebrate the 50th anniversary of Earth Day,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of other things along the way. On the 50th anniversary of the moonwalk, which is this summer,
yep.
We're going to have a major event around that. And then next year, we're going to have a new space show, and everybody loves a new space show. So there's lots coming.
There sure is. And perhaps the capstone of all this will be the $383 million Richard Gilder Center for Science, Education, and Innovation. What are those plans? And what will this mean to the future of the museum?
Well, this is a very important project. First of all, it's the first time that we've ever put what we actually do, in addition to our wonderful donor, Richard Gilder's name, but for science, education, and innovation. That's actually what we're about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that those words are particularly important now that people understand that. But inside of it is going to be really some thrilling things. I do want to say one word about the architecture, because our magnificent architect, Jeannie Gang,
yeah.
was just named to the Time 100 list. And I believe that the words that they used were that she's going to be, is the most important architect of our time, which is pretty great to hear. But why we chose her was, interestingly, because we're a museum and a park and we're very environmentally minded, we wanted somebody who had a great sensibility not only to the built environment, as you would expect mm-hmm. an architect to, but also to the natural environment. And Jeannie brings that to us, and she's produced a glorious building inside of which will be a couple of really fabulous things among many others. One is an insectarium. For all of the things that we have never had a grand hall for insects. Insects are one of the most important creatures on Earth today and probably always. Mm-hmm. They are a critical vector for human health, both good and bad. People tend to know the bad, not so much the good.
Yep.
And also for the environment. And we're going to bring all of that out. And they're everywhere, including right here in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the ones we don't like and some of the ones that we love. In addition to the insectarium, there's going to be a magnificent theater. It's called the Invisible Worlds Theater, and it will be a place that we take you to see the research that our scientists are doing in a pioneering way that almost always is not visible to the naked eye. And so we're going to take you to the depths of the ocean floor, the outer reaches of the atmosphere, inside the human body and the brain, or into a jungle and a leaf, and it's going to be quite different and quite fantastic. And one of the other things that really excites us about this building, and this may just be because we watch what happens there every day, for the first time, visitors are going to be able to come in and not hit dead ends and circulate around all the public floors in a way that will ease their journey and how crowded it can be.
Oh, that's so interesting. It does sound amazing. When is it going to open?
It's going to open in 2021. You know, it's a construction schedule.
I don't understand how that all goes, but it sounds like you do have a plan.
We have a plan. And we're excited about it.
Alan, running complex institutions like the American Museum of Natural History is one expensive enterprise. Are there any guiding principles you adhere to both on the expense and the revenue side?
I think there are a couple of things that one thinks about. Certainly when you take on a big project, you want to be sure you can afford it. And so we certainly, for most of our capital work, we certainly try to fund things up front.
Mm-hmm.
When it's a great big project, you get a big chunk of it up front, and then you might allow yourself time to finish it up.
Yeah.
But and so we adhere to that. We're fairly quite disciplined in these ways. So that I think that's first. I think on budgets, we believe in a balanced budget. And sometimes when you have new things, you have to say to yourself, well, what might we not do? That's usually very, very difficult. It's almost never about things that you don't admire. It's almost never about things that you don't wish you were doing. But it's hard, and you have to make choices.
And there are people involved.
Exactly.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your organizational culture and what makes the museum such a very special place in which to work.
I'm so happy to have that question today because in the context of our 150th, last night we had literally a birthday party, 150th birthday party for all of our staff, all of our volunteers,
oh,
and
great.
Our trustees. And one of the things that we talked about was how long people tend to work at the museum. We have people who have been there not 1 year, 5 years, though of course we have those as well, but 10 years, 20 years, 25
years. You don't find that in today's world.
That's right. 30 years, 40 years. We even had one fellow who's with us 50 years. And I think that tells you something about the place. First of all, I think people have a great passion about what we do for the institution. You mentioned at the beginning that there's nowhere that people love more. When I say what I do, most people will look at me and say, it's my favorite place.
Yeah.
How nice is that? But so would our staff, which doesn't mean we're perfect. On the other hand, we are representative in every way, I think, of New York City and its great diversity. Because of all that global work that we do, and we're truly a global institution, we have a global perspective. We're interested in different perspectives. We're about anthropology and different cultures. We are also, like almost every other institution that I know today, we're working really hard to do even better on issues of diversity and equity and inclusion, and surely we can. But we bring to it a real admiration and embracing of these issues, and I think our staff know it, which doesn't mean that they don't know what we don't get right sometimes, because we're all human.
Yeah, that's one of the greatest perks of working there, is telling somebody you work there, and your coolness factor goes up just like that.
You know, it's really true. Certainly mine has, but maybe I had a low start.
Boy, since you started back in 1993, society has changed dramatically. But I'd be curious how you have changed, and more specifically, how the way you lead this institution today is different than it was back in the early 1990s.
Well, I think we are more inclusive. I think you have to be today, and you have to seek more voices. I think that we live in very complex times, and I think in the immediate present, we live in times that are not only complex, but they're intense, and people bring a depth of feeling, whether it be born of anger, not necessarily at the institution itself, I mean in the condition that surround us all, or whether it be frustration or just passion for what they care about. And I think that therefore one leads with great sensitivity today, and with a strong desire to be inclusive. Although you can't include everybody in every decision, obviously, and you can't please everybody all the time. On the other hand, you can listen and you can be responsive as appropriate. So I think we're trying, all of us who are running institutions today are trying to do that better and better every day.
Yeah, it just seems that people sometimes will go along with the decision as long as their voice has been heard. And they'll go along with whatever you decide or whatever the institution decides. It's when their voice is not heard that they really get frustrated.
Well, the way that tends to be expressed in nonprofits like ours, and I think more and more in for-profits, is process. That if people feel and, in fact, are part of a process, and they both come away with a better understanding and they do feel heard.
Let me close with this, Ellen. Share with us a moment or two, perhaps a story that someone has told you and what the museum has meant to them, or maybe just capturing some kid taking this all in one day that maybe in the scheme of things isn't that big, but it was that big to them and really warmed your heart.
Well, I think one of the things that happened very early on when I was in the museum, and I just have always loved it, is you're wandering through, for me, in my case, going from one meeting to another.
Yes.
And as I'm wandering through, I look up and I see and hear a youngster standing in front of a diorama, and I see the parent or the caregiver saying, "Come on, come on, come on," as we all have done in our lives. And I think he looks at her and he just says, "Wait, I just gotta see this." Uh-huh. And that's the moment. I mean, it's the moment when you know that they're taking it in, because what our institution can do almost like no other is create a sense of wonder and reinforce a sense of curiosity. These are the gateways to learning. Mm-hmm. This is where it begins, an interest in science, an interest in the world around us, a desire to protect this environment, and boy, do we need it.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, Ellen Futter, the president of the American Museum of Natural History, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Now, you have a website which is solely dedicated to the 150th. Tell us about that and how people can get actively engaged in this anniversary.
Well, this goes directly, by the way, to your earlier question about how do we lead differently. One thing we do very differently is invite the public to engage with us and to participate way more than we ever used to. And I think that's true for everybody. So as part of our 150th, everybody should feel that they're part of it. And on our website, you can share with us a story, your reactions, anything you feel like. We're looking forward to receiving it and to hearing from all those people who love us.
Great idea. Well, there are going to be a lot of them. Thanks, Ellen. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Recruit the best talent. Explore the untapped pool of 24 million productive Americans with disabilities. The National Organization on Disability is the leading partner to help companies succeed in disability employment. Learn more at NOD.org. Follow The Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to The Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
There are 2.4 million public school students who have been identified with learning disabilities. As a result, just 68% of these students earn high school diplomas versus 91% of their peers. An organization led by two individuals who encounter some of these challenges themselves is making a big difference in the lives of these young people. It's called Eye to Eye, and it's a pleasure to have David Flink, their chief empowerment officer, and Marcus Sutra, who serves as president, with us tonight. Good evening, gentlemen, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for having us.
As I mentioned, both of you experienced learning disabilities growing up. Let me start with you, David, and ask you to tell us about the challenges of learning differently and how you went on to successfully navigate this path, which included graduating from Brown University.
So I grew up in 1980, and there was a lot that wasn't known. So for the first good chunk of my childhood, I knew there was something different. I could feel it, right? Like kids were learning to read, and I wasn't. I also have ADHD, so kids were sitting still and focusing, and it was quite obvious that I wasn't. And the gift that happened in fifth grade was that someone sat down and said, something's not right. And it's not that David's stupid. And so my life actually changed because I actually got diagnosed. I now like the word identified because it's part of my identity.
Yeah.
But I got these labels, this understanding that I was dyslexic and ADHD. And I went through the rest of my schooling and I had hit the parent lottery and the teacher lottery. And I got teachers who understood me and gave me what I needed, parents who gave me a lot of love, and I did go to Brown. As I went to Brown, the one thing that was really clear to me is even though I had all of this community of adults, I didn't have any real role models, any near-peer relationships of people who learned and thought like I did. So when I got to Brown, I said, okay, I'm going to figure this out. Mm-hmm. Step one is I need to find some other people on campus who have dyslexia and ADHD and other types of learning disabilities because I need community. Step two, I have a responsibility to give back. So I went to a local elementary school and middle school, and I said, okay, show me your dyslexic ADHD kids. And, you know, again, this is like late 80s, early 90s. They didn't ask for any background checks or who the heck I was. They said, here they are. And we started hanging out with little kids, and we built a community.
Yeah. And let me ask you about dyslexia. What exactly is it?
So dyslexia is based in your brain. It's a disability where the way in which your brain decodes letters is different than other people who don't have dyslexia. So literally when I look at a letter and I try and decode what that sound is, it takes a circuitous route in my brain to mm-hmm. be able to get to that answer. So that's the reason why people who have dyslexia often struggle with decoding words or spelling words, because they're having trouble making that connection. One of the things I would actually add is an interesting part about what is dyslexia. That circuitous route, that different thinking brain, also has unleashed a lot of creative thinking, a lot of problem-solving skills that other people don't have. So dyslexia is an interesting paradox of a struggle with one thing, and also there's a lot of research now to say a gift with another.
Yeah, yeah, it's a mixed bag.
It's a
no
mixed
question
bag.
About it.
In school, it's definitely often perceived of as a challenge.
Yeah, yeah. Marcus, tell us your story.
Yeah, my story is a little similar to Dave. I was identified with dyslexia and ADHD. They came together around third grade, and I found school to be an incredible struggle, and really didn't have any role models, and really didn't have any kind of sense that there was people with learning disabilities that were going on to college and being successful. We didn't have the out and proud celebrities that exist today with learning disabilities that we had when I was a kid, and so the message was clear: like, do not talk about this, don't embrace help, don't ask for accommodations, like just basically try and tough it out throughout school. And luckily, I would go home every night to as the parent lottery, as Dave put it, and had parents who were incredibly inspiring and motivating. And so I felt very intelligent throughout my school experience, but I didn't feel school was embracing that intelligence well. And so I said to myself, what could be the way that I could actually be effective in supporting kids? And so I went on to become a teacher. And I thought, okay, I'll be the teacher who understands these kids on a different level, can differentiate the instruction, be more empathetic to their struggles, whatever it is. But I'm not going to tell anybody I have a learning disability, that's for sure, because that was something I was not comfortable with. But I did know that it was going to inform the way I taught in the classroom. And then sure enough, a couple of weeks into my actually student teaching, before I even got my first job teaching, I started misspelling everything on the board, and my kids called me out on it. And as the way 16-year-olds can.
Oh, yeah.
They will call you on your stuff, right away. And so I realized that I had to embrace it. I had to tell them my story. And then I saw my story as a tool and as a way to change the culture of that classroom. And it was the kids were embracing their accommodations. The kids were – it normalized something that was really heavy and embarrassing and stigmatized for a lot of kids. And I started thinking, how do you scale this experience?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Dave and I very fortuitously got connected by a professor of mine at Keene State, who was kind of nurturing me in my first couple years of my career, and checking in with him. And because I was always good at finding mentors. That's something I always was really good about. And he said, this guy, Dave, he's running this thing. It was at Brown. And I heard him speak at this conference. I don't think he has a budget or an office or anything, but I think he might have a website.
And you still called him up.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I called him. I picked up the phone, and sure enough, Dave was the one answering the phone at the time. And I said, dude, what you're doing sounds really cool. And I'm doing something kind of similar in my one classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And we should get coffee. And we began a monthly chat. And then I started working, doing I'll volunteer, Dave. I'll do whatever needs to be done. And after that first year of teaching, I moved to New York in 2007 to work in Dave's apartment and really begin to kind of combine what Dave had learned from his experience at Brown and his education background in philosophy and my practice background at Keene State and what I had done in the classroom, and said, okay, let's combine these two experiences and build an organization.
Yeah.
Together.
And listen, listening to you two guys, David, it really just seems that you learn differently. And I think there's a lot of people think we just learn one way or a couple different ways. But you've done a lot of research on this. Tell us about the different ways that we all learn.
Yeah, I really feel that we need to reframe learning for our next generation. To your point, I think we've thought about learning as this way, like, you know, you open the head, you deposit the knowledge, you close the head, you're done. And of course, we actually know some of the most powerful learning experiences that we have in life are ones that happen outside the classroom or outside the sort of traditional form.
You're absolutely right.
So, I mean, no question I learned differently, and I'd actually argue that so do you, so does Marcus, so does our guy in the booth here. Mm-hmm. Thank you for editing, right? Like, everyone's doing something different. And so the actual excitement, and I think it's a human excitement when we can experience seeing somebody else's learning style, appreciating it, and feeding into it. And this can be a whole plethora. It can be interpersonal learning. It can be auditory learning. It can be experiential learning. And it might be, by the way, sort of sitting down, listening to a lecture and receiving knowledge. Mm-hmm. That's all good, too. You know, the soul lights up. We've all seen this and experienced it. And so I optimize in my life and also in my work to help those experiences happen more readily for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Marcus, tell us about Eye2Eye and what the organization specifically does to try to help these young people with these learning disabilities.
Sure, sure. So Eye2Eye is really trying to solve the equity issue that's in our education system. We do not have an equal playing field for all students and all learners. And so what we're trying to do is really improve the life outcomes of students with learning disabilities specifically. And they are the population that is dropping out at a rate 3 times of their peers. They're showing signs of depression at earlier ages. They're getting suspended, ending up in juvenile justice system. One study out of Texas showed that 50% of the inmates in prison in Texas had learning disabilities.
Wow.
So we really wanted to make sure that we could try and solve this problem. So the core of what we do is a mentoring program. We organize high school and college students with learning disabilities themselves, dyslexia, ADHD, other types of learning issues, and bring them into middle schools and use a social-emotional curriculum to teach younger students with learning disabilities about how they learn, teaching them, giving them a sense of community, really helping them advocate for themselves and their needs. That's such a huge component of this, that the research really shows us that if these students can advocate for themselves and their needs, that they can be successful regardless of the learning environment they're in. Learning keeps changing based on the environment that you're in. You know, learning is just a social construct like any other. And if you're able to advocate for yourself throughout high school, college, or the workplace, you're going to be much more successful.
Yeah.
So then we also do kind of broader outreach work. So we'll do community events to bring resources, speakers, knowledge to the communities who maybe don't have the mentoring program. The mentoring program currently is in 24 states at about 170 schools around the country. We also brought our curriculum onto an app format. So people can access Eye2Eye completely for free in their phones. So you just go to the App Store and type in Eye2Eye Empower, and you can download it there. And we also do kind of what we would call representation work or community building work. So we'll do a billboard series in Times Square for Disability Awareness Month with our students being the face of learning disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Or we'll appear on TV or PSAs at sporting events. And we'll also partner with organizations that do policy work. We were just recently on the Hill with our students advocating for the policies that are affecting their lives every day. So really bringing the face and voice to the movement as well as bringing this in-school intervention piece.
And arts would be at the heart of this mentoring program.
Yeah, it's a project-based learning, but if you walked into any one of our schools, any one of our programs, it's really art projects. I can give you an example of one. Yeah. So one of my favorite ones is, you know, when I was a kid, and a lot of kids are very popular superheroes right now, right? So Batman has his utility belt. He has all these things. No matter what happens to Batman, he seems to have something on his tool belt to solve it. And so what we build with our kids is our mentors come into the school and say, okay, we are kids with learning disabilities. We learn differently. We're going to need some tools to succeed in school. And so let's build utility belts, our own learning belts, essentially. And on those belts, these kids build things to help them with their spelling, things to keep them on time, something to be able to listen to their audio books. When we started off doing this, it was more physical things. And now it's basically a series of apps that kids would be able to utilize. But it gets the kid to talk about their challenges, talk about the accommodations. accommodations that are supporting them in school, and really kind of see that near peer role model, somebody who's just a little bit older than them, who's got some tips, some tricks to help them get through school. So really the art kind of breaks down that barrier and helps build that relationship.
Yeah, so workarounds and skills as to how to accommodate a society that sometimes is not all that accommodating.
Yeah. I mean, we wish school would be perfect, and one day maybe it will be, but until that day, we're going to give the kids the tips and tricks and strategies so that they can be successful in an environment that is broken and not fit for them.
Yeah. I can hear you guys want to change the culture of school, and that's really at the heart of a lot of it. Well, what's the impact of this program? Do you have outcomes in terms of these mentees who have been through your program?
Yeah, I think, you know, perhaps with my theory background, like, research was super important from the get-go. So we've been doing research on our work for the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And actually this month, we have a partnership most recently with a multi-year study done by UCSF out of California.
Yeah.
And this month, a peer-reviewed journal published this multi-year study. And what we found is that as we show up in these schools, these kids learn how to advocate for themselves, as Marcus was describing, and their grades go up, their depression goes down.
Mm.
I mean, the outcomes that often lead kids to prison are now reversed and are leading them to graduating from high school, college, and beyond. And so as I think about really what is now a moral responsibility, that this 20 years of work has said, your work works, and it can change kids' lives. I mean, Marcus and I spend a lot of time thinking about, now we have this undeniable responsibility to scale this work. And so, you know, the vast majority of time that we spend together thinking is, okay, it's terrific. We're doing a lot of really, really good work. But we know, as you began, like, there's 2.4 million kids out there. How are we going to get there? And we actually are very excited that we have a line of sight to solving that problem within the next 10 years.
Well, let's hear that line of sight, because I think one of the biggest challenges that the entire sector has is how to scale efficiently and effectively and quickly. And it seems that we have so many answers to so many problems, but we can't get them out there at scale. Tell us a little bit about that line of sight and what you plan on doing.
So I'll tell you where we're headed, and I'll tell you how we'll get there.
Okay.
So where we're headed is in the next 10 years, we're going to be in 50% of all schools in America serving middle schools who have these kids with diagnosed learning disabilities. And the way we're going to get there is what we realize is our volunteer corps, these young people, are actually the solution.
Mm.
And we often think about young people as problems to solve. In our case, and I think actually in most cases, these young people have the solution. They are the near-peer relationships. So we've now figured out, because of this incredible, you know, force of young people who are willing to share their stories and time, that we can get into schools by finding these high school students. We're basically a great recruitment program is what we are now, because we already have the curriculum. So we recruit these young people. We teach them how to be mentors, and we're scaling them to go to their local communities, schools that they know, sharing their stories and working now, you know, more extensively also with teachers so that they feel empowered. I think a lot of the magic of Eye to Eye has been to empower the young students to be able to say, I need this to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
But then also the teachers and the parents be able to say, that's okay. You said school culture. Half of the challenge is just to normalize that relationship, that exchange. Because what's happening right now is, even in the best case scenario where a kid says, I need this, well-intentioned adults say, you shouldn't do it that way, right?
Right.
And interestingly, when you get out of school using, say, an app to help you find directions or to remember something is okay, when you get into school, you have to remember all this stuff. And, you know, it's like crazy to me. So we're normalizing that culture in schools, and we're going to get there.
Yeah. Marcus, do a lot of the mentees ultimately become mentors?
Yeah, when you're getting as old as Dave and I are. I think that's one of the most kind of inspiring and beautiful things about this work is that our program team will go into a school and say, why are you choosing to volunteer? And, you know, every year more and more we're hearing students say, oh, well, I was a mentee in this program and now I'm ready to give back. And we have mentors who go on and say, I'm not done giving back. I want to be a teacher and work in the schools and continue this work in my own classroom, which is really, really exciting when you think about scale of not only of our mentees going on to be the leaders in education that we need to be able to transform these systems. So that's something that's been really exciting to see over the years as our mentees going on. And one of the wonderful things we do is when all of our students graduate from high school or from college is they get to wear an Eye-to-Eye cord when they graduate. We've mailed that to them. And this year we had a giant box that we got to mail out to all the students who are graduating. And, you know, a lot of our students aren't wearing the honor cords because they're not summa cum laude, which is fine as far as I'm concerned, but they are wearing their Eye-to-Eye cord when they graduate. And every year that box that we mail out in the spring gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah, that's wonderful. David, you have written a book called Thinking Differently, An Inspiring Guide to Parents and Children with Learning Disabilities. So let's talk a little bit about the parents. What advice do you have for them?
So I think number one is, you know, almost similar to Mark's story, maybe even a bit more than mine, is parents need to feel comfortable with the idea that these labels aren't bad things. And half of the choice to write this book and to share my journey and also the journey of many, many other students who came through Eye-to-Eye was to really help parents feel it's okay to say these words out loud, to tell them to your kids, and to help these kids find their community. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what is in that book is giving parents the tools to be able to do that for their kids, because like Marcus said, we're not going to be able to be in every community, but we can inspire every community to see greatness in young people.
Marcus, tell us a little bit more about that app.
Yeah.
That website, I mean, how people can access some of this information before you get to them.
Yeah, definitely. So the app is the freest and fastest way to get involved with Eye-to-Eye right now. And we were really thinking about how can we make sure that what we've learned from our program, what we've learned from this study with UCSF can get to more individuals. It's not the same as having a mentor in your life, but it is something that everybody can access, which is so important to us. So the app is a series of quests, kind of similar to based on the art projects or project-based learning that we do in schools, where students identify their strengths, their weaknesses, what accommodations they need, helps them with their goal setting. And then what students in schools right now have is, for people who don't know, they have an IEP or a 504. That's mm-hmm. their legal document that guarantees them the rights to be in school, get extended time on tests, a note taker, use audiobooks, whatever that accommodation would be. The same thing with a student who might need a ramp to get into a building. You know, students might need an audiobook to listen to a book. So every year there's a meeting with the family, the parents, the teachers, the principals, whoever, to make sure this document is correctly put together. And what the app does is prepare the student to be involved in that meeting. Because mm-hmm. so often the students have been siloed and not a part of that conversation.
Yeah, you're right.
And then they're told, hey, you better advocate for yourself. And it's like, well, I haven't been given the tools or the strategies on how to do that. So the app actually, after you're done going through all the, I believe it's 8 quests that the students go through, it collects all that data, aggregates it, and puts it into a PDF that you can, an 11-page document that you can share with your teachers, your parents, your whoever, your case manager, and now gives that student a voice in that meeting, whether they're there physically or not. So it's really preparing them to be able to advocate for their legal rights.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff.
And you know, it's interesting, you're probably getting a sense of how the two of us work together. So Marcus and his team created the app, and me and my team created the book. And the book is the blueprint for the parents, and the app is the blueprint for the kids. And then, of course, all that is working in concert with the school. So we're really just trying to come in a holistic way and support these communities because we know everybody can succeed. We just got to give everybody the right frame and tools to be able to do that.
Well, that's about the cleanest division of labor I think I've ever heard.
It's not always
I know what I do.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm so glad we came on your show so we could clear that all up.
We've been working together for 12 years without a job.
Yeah. No, here we go.
Just
we
got it.
We got
it.
Marcus was looking like, really? That's what we're doing? So you have a very interesting place in which to work. Tell us a little bit about the corporate culture, Dave.
So it's interesting, right? You heard Marcus at the beginning saying we were working out of my apartment. That's true. It's over in Tompkins Place in Brooklyn. You can go check it out. Not many people want to. Once we moved out
nice
of the – I mean, it's a nice neighborhood, but there's no reason why you'd go look at some apartment that Dave and Marcus worked out of. As soon as we had literally a staff of 3, mm-hmm. we said, okay, we have to pay attention to the same advocacy that we're instilling in our schools, helping people work in a way that optimizes for their learning. We have to do in our workplace. And so everything that we advocate for in our schools, we do in our workplace. So just like our community, although we over-index in people who learn and think differently, since we are for and by people who learn and think differently, our employees, about 75%, have things like dyslexia and ADHD. And so we create the same as we ask for in schools, work IEPs, environments where people can say, hey, you know, I learn better this way or that way. And we try and frame for each person a model for which they can succeed. And it's been very exciting to see, you know, articles in Forbes celebrating us as one of the best places to work and getting like the best in the top 10 nonprofits to work at and things like that. Because all we really did was say, hey, you know, I'm going to need this accommodation. Like, I'm dyslexic. So if you send me like a long memo, I'm probably not going to read it. But if you let me, you know, have it in an audio format, I will. That's not a hard accommodation. It's exactly what we asked for in school. So it's now, you know, companies are coming and asking us, hey, like, can you come over to Goldman Sachs and help us think a bit about it? It turns out, especially people on the trading floor have a lot of ADHD. What do we need to do to make sure that they succeed? And we're really just playing the same game that we've been playing in school in the workforce. And, you know, in America, we need to make sure we have a workforce that can succeed.
And that means the same things we're trying to do in school have to pertain to what people show up in the workplace today.
Absolutely. And it's always so nice when your culture is aligned with the actual work you do during the day. And you don't find that alignment in a lot of organizations. Well, both of you have great stories. Marcus, share with us a story of someone who's been through your program and the difference that it's made in their lives.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many stories. I'll think about one that we just had an event out in San Francisco, and we honored one of our alumni. And her name is Vanessa Montgomery, and she lives in San Diego. And I think about Vanessa, not only was she in our program, but she's now an educator herself, kind of what I was speaking about before, that she is not just embraced eye-to-eye in the program, but is living eye-to-eye throughout her entire life. And so Vanessa is a student out there in the San Diego area working with eye-to-eye, and now is a teacher who's running her own learning disability conferences at the school, getting other teachers trained, giving them the knowledge to be able to do their work. You know, she's brought her own story as a perspective of how she teaches and how she lives in the classroom. So she's not only a symbol of success, but she's bringing all that she's learned about being a professionally trained educator and, you know, the work that she's done, you know, at Eye to Eye into the classroom. And that's something that's really exciting, I think, for Dave and I to think about somebody who will probably be around after we're gone, who's still doing this work and not just like, not just a one-off. And I think that's something that's really important when we think about the work that Eye to Eye is doing and a lot of other amazing organizations, is it's not just like the one-day fundraiser or the car wash or whatever it is, that like this is something that these people are doing every single week in schools. Our students will do over 100,000 hours of community service this year.
That's great.
And, you know, being able to then carry on and kind of live that as a part of their life and not just a one experience they had for a year in college.
And I would add actually just an additional piece. I mean, to see mentee go to mentor, and then in the case of Vanessa, becoming a teacher. But also, you know, we have alumni, some of whom sit on our board, mm-hmm. who've been through the entire program, and now they're giving philanthropically to support the organization. We have alumni who've, you know, worked in startups, a couple that I won't mention by name, but let's just say they've gone IPO'd recently, and they're very public about their learning and attention issues, and that's changing culture and big business. I mean, what's exciting is to not just see these mentees become mentors and graduate, but to see that they are taking their stories as a community into wherever they go and creating change.
That's great. Let me close with this for both of you, and that is for a young person with dyslexia or ADHD or some other learning disability, what word of encouragement would you be able to give them to inspire them to forge ahead? Dave?
What word of encouragement? I mean, I think they have to understand that they are part of one of the largest hidden minorities in our country, right? They are 1 in 5 people in America. And because we are told that it's a disability and it's something you shouldn't talk about, you can't find your community. So my first word of encouragement is tell someone, right? If you start with just telling your story, guaranteed, 1 in 5 people are going to give you a high five. I remember when we first started, I didn't know how to find other people. I literally made T-shirts. I would walk around and say, like, this is what dyslexia looks like.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, people would come up to me and say, hey, that's me. I mean, some of them were a little more eye-catching. I said, you know, I put the sexy in dyslexia. We don't make that one anymore. But I found a lot of people that way. Whatever it takes to tell your story, that's step one. The rest will follow.
Mm-hmm. Advertising is really important.
It turns out. It's the same reason why we do billboards in Times Square. You can do it in Times Square, or you can do it in your local community by just telling your story.
Yeah, and it also puts you at ease once you get it out there because you're not trying to cover it up anymore.
That's
and
right.
You can just be yourself. Marcus, what would you add?
I mean, I think the loneliness piece is something that a lot of – anyone who has a hidden disability or a hidden difference of any kind, I think it feels very, very alone. And I think that there's value in not only you sharing your story, as Dave was saying, to benefit somebody else, but it does benefit you as well. And it does allow you to feel more comfortable in this space, and it allows you to be more successful. If you're working in an office right now and you're like, man, if I only had X, Y, and Z, I could be more successful. You need to talk to your boss about that. You need to advocate to HR about those things because they want you to be successful. They're going to most likely, unless it's a really place we probably shouldn't be working, they're going to embrace that because they're going to want you to be successful at the end of the day. So I think just understand that you're not alone, and that by telling your story, you can not only change someone else's life, but you can also change yours.
Can I actually insert an additional thing around people who are a little older?
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking before we got on the air about Vanessa Kirsch. Founder of New Profit, one of our board members, one of the first supporters of Eye to Eye. And I remember when I first met Vanessa, you know, what I said to her is like, obviously, you have a great lens in terms of how to scale nonprofits. And for those listening who haven't heard that interview, you should go back and listen to the New Profit interview. It's terrific. But one of the things that I said to Vanessa, I said, look, I happen to know you're dyslexic. Like, I've seen you talk about it, but like, I don't see you talk about it that often. And they hold this big gathering. Some of the leading social entrepreneurs and business people come to that gathering. And I said, you know, I'd be excited to work with you and think about how to scale Eye to Eye. But what I want you to do next, if you're willing, is at that next gathering. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people from around the world come to this. Start the gathering by saying, hey, I'm Vanessa Kirsch, and I'm dyslexic. And raise your hand if you are too. And she said, I hadn't thought about that. I was like, all the philanthropy you do in the world is going to be great. But if you do that, it's going to change things. And she got up the next, you know, however many weeks or months later, I remember, and did that. And guess what? Like one in five people raised their hand. And actually, I think we over-indexed in the social entrepreneurship sector. So I think it was even more.
Entrepreneurship completely.
Yeah. Entrepreneurship completely, yeah. I think one in three CEOs in America and Fortune 500 companies are dyslexic. So, you know, telling your story at a young age is important, and continuing to tell it is also important.
Super. Well, David Flink, CEO, and Marcus Sutra, president of Eye to Eye, I want to thank you both for being here tonight. Hey, David, tell listeners about your website and some of those tools that are out there that can help them right away.
So I hope you'll visit eyetoeyenational.org, where we have resources that we've mentioned on the show, the app, my book, also a film which we didn't discuss called Road Trip Nation, which is a great film to just sit down and watch with your kids. It's a story of young people going through America, meeting successful adults who have learning and attention issues. You can also go to davidflink.com to learn a bit more about me. And I would say there's while you're on the EyeToEye website, you should go and check out our diplomats. We didn't touch on it too much, but just to end there, our diplomats are a group of trained young people who can come into your schools, share their stories, and start to set the conversation in motion. So EyeToEye National and EyeToEyeNational.org and davidflink.com.
Well, I want to thank you both. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. This was a blast.
And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.